Hello and welcome to Into the Wild, the podcast that brings you wildlife facts, conservation updates and nature stories from the professionals to you. That's the worst I've ever done that. Before I move on to today's show, I'd like to give a quick message to my listeners. The UK is currently in its second national lockdown and globally there has been, as always, a lot of news hitting the screens. I want to remind you all of something very important. Enjoy your outdoors time. In the UK, it's now autumn, and whilst the colours are beautiful, the weather is cooling and getting a lot damper, but I urge you all to still do that minimum of 1 hour's exercise outdoors where it's safe to, and when you do, listen, look and enjoy. If you're out on a walk now and listening to this episode, please stop. Listen to it when you're at home, when you're cooking or doing your housework. Outdoors time should be about what you can hear and see. Trust me, it helps. So stay well, and now, on with the show. It's been said many times that rewilding land and reintroductions of species is key to saving biodiversity and assisting with the battle of climate change. One man that knows not only the info but the challenges of the work itself is ecologist, reintroduction specialist, farmer and author of Bringing Back the Beaver, Derek Goh. I feel pumped after every chat I do for Into the Wild, however this conversation with Derek left me feeling that tad bit more motivated. From chats about what rewilding is and how it's done, and with what species, to the more complex of what we need to be careful about, and the big question for me, will we ever have wolves back in the UK? Derek gives some great detail in this show and I'm super excited to bring it to you all. So thanks so much for tuning in and enjoy the show. Derek, welcome to Into the Wild, the podcast. Thank you so much for joining me. First things first, how are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you. I'm inside now. It's blowing a hoolie from Dartmoor, threatening to do that. So I'm inside enjoying a cup of peppermint tea.
Nice. But
yeah, absolutely fine.
Awesome, man. Well, like I said, it's an absolute pleasure to talk to you. I've been really looking forward to not only the topic that we're going to be talking about today, because it's a very topical one this year, but also just chatting with yourself. For the listeners, let's start with the basics. Do you want to tell everyone who you are and what is it you do?
My name is Derek Goh, and I've worked with on a variety of different reintroduction projects, but with Eurasian beavers on a variety of restoration projects for the last 25 years. I've also done quite a lot of work with waterbill reintroduction, and at the moment I'm rewilding about half of my farm, returning it to nature with animals like heck cattle, wild boar, buffalo, and a whole variety of different things that are going to reshape the land and create living space for other smaller creatures.
That's amazing. Do you know what? Whenever I hear someone talk about this, it's almost inspiring to hear that people are doing this work. Do you feel kind of like motivated when you talk about it as well?
I generally just feel tired, but yeah, today. Having a look, with some guys from another project, and we've just finished and built a captive breeding facility for wildcats, which we hope to move on with a reintroduction of in England in the next few years.
Wow.
There's no good reason why they shouldn't be restored. The reasons why they were killed in the past have all passed in time. And when you're wandering through in the sun shining, and you've got some of the big males and kittens, sitting just outside their boxes looking at you, then yes, you can see that the thing is moving on and it's, making some sort of progress, but it's not an easy ride by any manner of means. And there are very many people who think this should not be. So, it's at times deeply satisfying, but when you're kind of like at the coal face, most of the time, all you can ever see is the imminent danger of the coal wall facing you collapsing in. So
that
generally tends to be the focus.
Another question we always lead with on Into the Wild is how and when did your love for nature and wildlife begin? Was there a specific moment for yourself?
Well, I'm 55, and of my generation, there are very many people who read Gerald Durrell's books. And we're inspired by this man's tales of saving little animals from all over the world, pink pigeons and Rodriguez foot bats and all manner of things that, were tiny and obscure. So that's where my love of nature, I was certainly doing this sort of thing. I always had an enduring love of nature. Mm. But the idea that, we really needed to help nature and that it was in a fairly perilous place, I guess came from Gerald Durrell's books. He was the most marvelous writer. The most inspirational man. So that's where my enthusiasm for doing this came from.
My next question, and this one I'm quite intrigued to know about, but have you always felt the need, being
a farmer yourself. Have you always felt the need for farming to benefit nature? Is this something that you learned or kind of decided to change along the way?
I've been involved with agriculture for a very long time, and like many people who still are involved with agriculture, when I was farming at any kind of scale, you view it a very certain way. You breed your lambs to suit a certain grading style that is going to get you the highest price from Waitrose. You inject them when the regime tells you to inject them. You basically farm in an entirely conventional way, looking after your livestock, myopically focused on their best interests, and on pretty much nothing else. So I think it's fair to say that, when I was in that mode, I didn't really think about much other than how we were going to farm. But then year on year, as you spent doing it, and you looked at, strange things started to happen. You started to, to notice that the wheat ears that were coming over to Dartmoor, because they migrate, one of the migratory routes is across our farm, that year on year, the numbers are getting lower. And that one year we had a pair that formed up in a hay field, and for a time it looked as if they might breed. And then, of course, it was a season when there wasn't a lot of grass, and we had to let the cows in, and the cows basically just ate off all the cover and probably pounded any eggs there were into the ground. And and time after time over, as the years went by, you'd look at, this odd happening, some little thing that in its own right would seem insignificant. But in a cumulative sense, when you started to look at how this was panning out with regard to species after species, you began to realize that really what you thought was absolutely right in your own mind and what the community around you was telling you was the right thing to do. In the end, you began to realize that, really, it wasn't. So, I think even for me, and I had an interest in natural history and nature conservation that was strong, and professionally that's what I was doing, the farming thing was not an easy journey, because you kind of like become part of something that's quite evangelical. It thinks it's right even when it's wrong, and is always has always really tended to defend that position to the death rather than try to rationalize it. So I couldn't honestly say that when I had any great degree of farming involvement that my impact on other things troubled me greatly. But as time went on, it began to trouble me more and more, and it became quite obvious that much of what we were doing simply wasn't correct, and there were only two ways of proceeding, and one was to carry on with what you were doing regardless of the cost to the natural world, and also regardless of the cost financially from doing it, again, to be frank, we were farming in pretty much the same way as everybody else in the communities around us, and what we did was produce a perfect model of failure by doing so. But nevertheless, if you're involved with farming and you have any feeling for animals, one of the most appalling parts of it is getting to the stage where you know that what you're doing is wrong, and then also getting to the stage where you know that the only way to make it right is to actually start to look at the animals that you've kept, some of them for years, at the flocks and the herds that you built up. And if you were going to come to a different compact with nature and use the land in a different way, all those animals that you felt, some of which you felt very strongly for, were going to have to go. And that was not an easy thing to do either. For the cows, which are animals that live for a long time. We had grandmothers, granddaughters, mothers, and you look at them and think, you too. It was not an easy ride, but in the end, if we wanted to change things, it had to be a different course, and that course meant that there had to be fewer animals, different animals, animals that were there to do the job of creating living space for other creatures, and that's what we've done.
That's amazing, and when you're talking about that, it makes me feel very much like, why wouldn't someone change and do that? Like you said, it's a two-way street. You go one way that's not sustainable on any means, or you go the other way, which is a bit more work maybe, but you produce more. I don't know. Maybe that's a very naive way of thinking about it, but am I right in saying any of that?
Well, what it requires, last week I went out to see a commercial forester who, an incredibly intelligent man who's producing the most amazing results in sense of biodiversity. From forests he's managing through
developing a thing called continuous cover, okay? And continuous cover is that basically you don't ever go in and fell complete blocks, even if they're commercial forestry. What you do is thin and prune, you encourage thickets, you retain dead wood, you perhaps even look at your forest and recognise that there have to be areas of old wood pasture in it or grazing lawns or whatever else. And the thing is, when you go out and you look at somebody like that, and you look at what that man has achieved on the land he is managing, and you look at the forest structure and the results from the surveys, there is no argument about what he is doing is right.
Yeah.
If you then turn around and wander down to the commercial plantations that are down the road from where I live on the edge of Dartmoor, and you just have these dull, monolithic ranks of Sitka spruce marching off into the distance with not a damn bit of variety and no broadleaves and no deadwood and no nothing, what you have is an exploitative crop in the same way that a monoculture of cereal, you know, sprayed with pesticide is, you know, there's no great difference. In the end, you're looking at something that has very little life in it. But to change anything requires a new way of thinking. It requires intelligence, it requires determination, it requires courage, because it's easier in many ways to keep on following a herd and prepare yourself to fail with every single year that it comes, rather than say, right, okay, look, this is just not where I want to be, and I want to do something that's different. In his situation, you can see clear intelligence. If you look at something like, you know, some of the really amazing examples that are in arable farmland in the east of England, you know, where they're actually, you know, not rewilding anything. They're using, you know, they're using, again, you know, good crop statistics, knowledge of yields, you know, knowledge of soils, knowledge of what's important for wildlife and season to create the most amazing corridors through farmland, which are literally brimming with life. An opportunity for a whole host of species, then again you see thought. But that element of thought, I think, with regard to what we do in land use, is really pretty unusual. And it's easier, as I said, to go along with it the same old than it is to think. So one of the biggest problems is that we just don't think. We think it's okay and we think it's all right and everybody else agrees with us, and then you go on and do what you're going to do. So for me, I think one of the hardest things was just, you know, changing the way I viewed things, changing my mind, accepting there were going to be challenges and surprises and that, you know, I couldn't entirely quantify every single outcome. But once you start down the road of looking at what, you know, at the changes as they happen, then it just becomes an enchanting thing.
And it's those traits you just said are maybe some things that people in the UK are not great at doing.
No, we're a very insular race. We have this blown up, pompous idea of where we are, both as a people and certainly of our image in a world stage. And you know, really, we're not good at change. We're very conservative, very slow, very keen not to rock boats. And that's at a time when, you know, we know that, you know, from, you know, all the scientific evidence that is, that, you know, we're looking at a climate change pattern, the likes of which we've never seen before, that those boats, by Christ, are going to start rocking. And the only way, you know, we can hope for or look to salvation is to actually change what we do. And part of that is going to be, you know, changing landscapes to hold more carbon, to slow the flow of water, you know, to restore soils. It's a whole range of different things that, you know, we've just not really begun to think about. We've taken from everything and given back very little. And now we're going to have to reshape this landscape in the interests not only of nature, but also of wider society to try to get to a place where, you know, we help our planet to heal.
My next question is, I didn't even think whether I was needing to put this question in until I was speaking to a few people over the weekend who aren't as immersed into wildlife and nature than you and I may be. But when we talk about rewilding, they didn't even know what that meant. And that's when I thought I better put this question in. So when we're talking about rewilding, what does that actually mean?
Well, rewilding is that basically you take your foot off the pedal and you start to allow some areas of land, be they old dairy farms or forests or improved, semi-improved grassland, to start to find its own way. And that to do that, one of the things you can do, though it doesn't apply to every set of circumstances, that you can start to put animals in, which are the proxies for the animals, which would have been there in the past, things like, you know, but you know, cattle, different British cattle breeds instead of our oxen, you know, different British breed, pig breeds such as Tamworth instead of wild boars. You start to put animals into an area of land to create the habitat that smaller creatures, be they, you know, plants, you know, or sedges or frogs, can then use to get to a point where this whole becomes, you know, a self-fulfilling system which just pumps out life. And if you want the most splendid example of that, what you've got to do is, you know, buy Wilding by Isabella Tree and look at the story that and the wonder that is Knepp Castle. You know, a dairy farm that was part of a broken system, exhausted soils, poor farmland anyway, you know, an economic situation that simply wasn't going to work. And just look at the journey those marvelous people made. You know, to the point where Knepp is just this outstanding, you know, jewel of hope, thrumming with purple emperor butterflies, you know, singing nightingales, just an absolute marvel, because they took the foot off the gas, they put the landscape creators back into the environment, and they let the land develop its own course and its future, assisted by the natural functions of the big animals.
And this is probably a quite a broad question, or maybe it requires a broad answer, but how easy is it to do on land? Obviously it may be dependent on where you are, but how do you get started with rewilding?
I think it's a difficult, it depends very much on where you are and what has been done to the land that you are the steward of. So for us, you know, a lot of, for example, the pasture was all semi-improved, so there's not a great complement of wildflowers left. There are some herbs around the edge. There are patches and perhaps areas of plantation that haven't been disturbed for 20 years. But in essence, what we had was something that's either plantation woodland or grasses, and those grasses were all semi-improved, you know, ryegrass mixtures, which once in place are incredibly dominant. So for us, it wasn't the case that we were starting with bare soils and arable weeds and scrub coming in quickly in response to just being left. It was a case of, well, we've got these pastures and we've got some plantation and we've got some tiny bits of ancient woodland and there's some tiny bits of wetland, but we didn't have to wait to start putting animals in.
Yeah.
And again, it's all a bit kind of suck it and see, because we're not Knepp and we're not 3,000 you know, acres of land in central Sussex. You know, we're playing about with 150 acres, you know, in horrible wet Devon. But the long and the short of it was that, you know, probably we've had a few more animals in there than we should have done. But some of those animals, like the Iron Age pigs, have already done, you know, just accomplished marvels. I mean, they've turned, you know, 30 acres of the land over completely last winter. They've taken something that was flat and they've made it ridged and furrowed. They've created pools and cups, so that when the water hits the land, it no longer runs off quickly. It's held by these myriad elements of ploughing that the pigs have undertaken. And they're in the bottom of our valley, there are beavers, very many beavers. And of course, as that water goes down to the bottom now, there's just beaver dam after beaver dam, wherever the water can be forced up into the woodland, the dams extend higher and off to one side. So, you know, what you're looking at is a landscape that's reforming, and once complete will be the most amazing large fen, you know, full of butterflies, full of fish, full of amphibians, with otters hunting through and raptorial birds like herons coming down to perch on the felled trees to scoop up the bounty that flows past them. But that's a landscape that is entirely dependent on the animal as an architect, in the same way that the pigs are an architect of the higher land. And it's also a landscape we associate with low-lying areas of Britain. We just don't think these environments develop higher up. But of course they do, if you take off your you know, your blinkers and you allow nature to start refinding its way.
It sounds like an absolute haven when you're saying it, and I'm sure it is when it all is completed, with all these animals just working on this landscape that's like a great grandfather clock or something like that, with all its cogs just spinning around. It sounds absolutely beautiful. The other thing you, well, I guess this is coinciding with rewilding, is reintroduction. And this is something I've seen you focus on a lot with beavers, as you said at the beginning, for one example. But how can reintroducing an animal back into an ecosystem help the environment and the wildlife that's there?
Well, for something like the beaver, it's a really simple answer. At the end of the day, this is not just another reintroduction. This is an animal which is fundamentally critical for healthy landscapes. And when you take the beavers out, this natural function of slowing the flow, holding water in valley bottoms, creating a landscape that's both flood and drought resistant, creating a landscape that's incredibly complex and into which a whole myriad of wetland wildlife species are completely interdependent. None of that happens if you don't have the beaver. So the beaver is a simple one. You're not just restoring a single species when you look at the beaver. Yeah. What you're looking at is you're restoring a whole lost component in the engine of life. And without that, you know the engine just can't function. It's like trying to run a truck without oil in it. Yes, it'll stumble on for a wee while, but in the end, the thing will just go bang. Yeah. And you'll be sitting looking at the wreckage. You know, really, that's pretty much where we are. But so restoring the beaver is a thing that's much more important than a single species. Restoring other species, well, you do it for different reasons. I mean, things like pine marten being restored to central Wales in the Forest of Dean now, and in the very near future, very many other sites in England potentially as well. Well, that animal was hunted to extinction by us because the medieval fur trade wanted it, then the Elizabethans decreed it to be vermin, then the gamekeepers who came, you know, murderously to the landscape after the Industrial Revolution gave a variety of men a lot of money to enjoy their hunting, shooting, fishing whims. These animals were wiped out for not a single reason it was good. And as soon as you take an animal like this out, any component part of nature, you take one part out and other things start to misfunction. So, you know, what you end up with, you've none of these medium-gilled mammal predators are landscapes where, you know, things like a grey squirrel, an introduced species, which is very few native predators at all of a sudden starts to dictate through debarking the structure of commercial forestry in Britain. So if you speak to some foresters, they will tell you that there's been no commercial broadleaf woodland planted in Britain in the last 25 years because the squirrels so destroy the value of the trees that it simply can't be done. Wow. And you know, you look at it and think, we're in an environment where a squirrel is dictating the future direction of the forests. It's insane. So restoring animals like that because they're very effective predators of grey squirrels is a really good idea. For things like water voles, it's you know, we live in a landscape which is largely devoid of wildlife. And one of the critical challenges that's going to face us if we're looking to turn this sinking ship that's already halfway under the ocean surface round and refloat it is going to be to reconnect food webs. And to do that, you need more food. You know, if you look at the statistics and the evidence, you know, from a number of studies which suggest that insects have declined by 75%. Amphibians, you know, once common, once abundant, again have suffered significant, you know, national and international decline. Small mammals, all these things are the basis of a food chain. And if you don't have them in great abundance, you cannot have higher life building up in their absence. So, you know, water voles you'd restore because they are a great food resource. They're not full of rodenticides and toxins in the way that they're rats which inhabit our farmlands and hedges are, so things can eat them, you know, without killing themselves. You know, there are all sorts of different reasons why you would restore some species rather than others. But for some species, it's not just about nature, it's about hope. You know, one of the birds that I worked on, have worked with in the last few years is the white stork. We're working with Nepcastle and others to reintroduce this species to the British Isles. And though the evidence of their former existence is very grainy, we know they were here. And because this bird is a trusting bird and long associated with people and their settlements, all that's certain is we almost inevitably just ate them to extinction in the past. And at a time when we really need to reconnect people with nature, to get them away from their computer diversions and all the other things that life and consumerism throws at you to distract your mind from what you really are, we wanted to bring back a bird that was in your face, that one day will nest on the roof of your school, your church, your house, your bungalow, your Lidl or your Asda, and by bill clattering there and feeding its pterodactyl-like chicks, you're going to have people with tiny kids going in and looking up and thinking, oh my God, I did not know that these things were in Britain. I did not know that we had wildlife that could be like this and that the future could be better than the grim grey that confronts us now. So that's why you'd perhaps choose a bird like the stork. It's not about one bird. Mm. It's about reconnecting people with wonder. And it's amazing when you look at this, you know, the COVID, this plague that we've lived with for the best part of a year now, and which is coming back again now as we approach Christmas and to confront us once again. That when those storks bred at Knepp in the spring of the year and then hatched and fledged their chicks in the summer, Izzy got hundreds of thousands of people, you know, sending notes back, little texts, messages to say just how amazing and what inspiration, what hope they took from this bird, you know, producing the first chick since the Reformation in England and those chicks flying free. You know, so there's a lot, you know, we've lost the whole link with our natural links with nature as symbology and something that's like a beating heart of a land. It's become something that's distant and obscure and not important anymore. But it shows you when you have a response like that, just how elemental these things are and how moved people can be by spectacles that birds like the stork produce.
Well, I think it's clear I'm definitely not going to look at a grey squirrel in the same way ever again. You've mentioned a couple of species there. In the UK, are there other key species for you that you think we should aim to reintroduce? We said about the white stork and the beaver being, you know, from two very different ways essential. And what would be the benefits of these other key species, do you think?
I think we should consider many things. I mean, you know, you have some people who will talk about rewilding and they'll say it's not about wolves and bears. Well, okay, right here, right now, in this life, it might not be. Mm. I think we should absolutely look at the restoration of the Eurasian lynx, because this is an animal that's a woodland predator. It's going to be a predator, a very effective predator of small to medium-sized deer. Is it going to control deer and create a situation whereby deer are not the problem they are with regard to either predation of trees or road traffic accidents? Well, probably not, but it's part of this missing component, again, in the circle of life. So if you have, you know, lynx killing deer, you have more dead deer lying out in the forest. You've got the remains, the bones going back into the soil, you know, birds like woodpeckers eating the invertebrates that decompose them, you know, all sorts of soil microorganisms benefiting from their fat and their hair and the whole elemental animal as it degenerates into the soil. I think the lynx is something we should look at quite seriously now, and we should do now. I don't think there's a huge challenge with it. The problem we have with lynx is that, of course, Britain is one of the most deforested countries in Europe. So when you look at landscapes like you know, Purbeck or Dartmoor, in large parts they are large, arid, open, treeless waste, because we cut the forests down in the Bronze Age, over-farmed them then, and from there on in we pretty much just ruthlessly exploited any commodity they had. We took out the iron ores, we took out the slate, we quarried, we took lime, we used everything there pretty much was and what woods remained. And then in the end, where there was nothing much left, we farmed them. Mm. And now that's because of our leaving the European Union and the subsidies declining, which were given to sheep farmers, you know, just to keep sheep. They didn't have to make much money. They just kept sheep and they got a huge amount of taxpayers' loot to do so. Those are finishing. And it's very likely that what's going to happen is that for very many farming systems are simply no longer going to be viable without public subsidy, because they're not producing anything that's of significant worth. And it's going to change again. So the challenge now is what we do with this change, and what we could do with this change is say, well, look, we spent a lot of public money on creating this mess. You know, if people really want to, we could start to spend public money on sorting it out. And yeah, there's a very good case for doing that, not just for the esoterics of nature, though that should be something that, you know, makes our hearts quicken and gladdens our very existence. But because, you know, you create landscapes with forests that had deep and rich absorbent leaf litter that would slow the flow of water, that would be caught in the beaver dams that these wonderful rodents would engineer there, that would mean that, you know, people year on year as winter comes are not in their houses and communities worrying about the next flood call and then, you know, sweeping all the sewage a foot and a half deep out of the little girl's bedroom again. You know, we've acted in the interests of a few. Now it really is time for politicians to start thinking about acting in the interests of many. And the portents are all there. It's been made quite clear that any money coming for land use will be public money for public goods. And that does not mean people keeping sheep as pets. It means a very different thing.
Now, with reintroductions as well, I guess a big thing, we've spoken here about the, and mixed with rewilding as well, the blissful nature that can come after many years of work with this. But what do we have to do in order to ensure that they don't have unintended ecological consequences when we have reintroductions?
Okay, we have to be sensible about this, but we have to look at what we know. We have to look at what experience there is elsewhere in the world. And when it comes to unintended consequences, well, what exactly are they? Are they? I mean, it's even people who are involved in nature conservation will tell you, well, we have to be careful about unintended consequences. But then when you look at the landscapes that surround these tiny last bits of nature, or where these few fragile species are trying desperately to remain, there are other unintended consequences. Look, for example, at the development of silage as a fodder crop for cattle. It was never intended that this should scalp the landscape bare to the point where there are virtually no wading birds or ground nesting birds left, where an animal as small as a short-tailed vole can't exist in a meadow because it's going to be cut four times and it and its tiny babies are going to be minced. Look at the unintended consequences of mechanical hedge flailing, you know, where the glowworm colonies have been entirely eliminated from the landscape. When we look at reintroductions, you know, it's not even a case of well-planned and well-executed. There are no real examples of anything that's been reintroduced going seriously or fundamentally wrong, because at the end of the day, these things that we are reintroducing are part of the natural ecology of this island. They should be here. The problems and the destruction doesn't come from a few reintroduced species, a few eagles or a few beavers. The problem and the destruction comes from the way that we use the land in other forms. And I think that's the principal thing that people who say, right, okay, we have to be concerned about unintended consequences need to focus on. It's not, you know, an eagle eating a lamb that's worth, you know, really, you know, at the end of the day, next to nothing. It's all the other destructions that are going on, which basically do fundamentally incalculably more damage than anything an eagle or a beaver's going to do.
That's a really good answer, and I think I've never really considered it from that angle as well. Is kind of going, well, the stuff was here, so why don't we just crack on? And surely the consequences that will be. It's, I guess I'm, again, maybe naively, but looking at it going, the only thing that could happen is good.
We mustn't be afraid of our own shadows in any of this. You know, if there's a problem, we'll sort it. But at the end of it all, what we should be doing is sitting like a wee boy who's just about to piss his pants, you know, on the sideshow in the theatre with his mum and saying, oh, we can't do this, we can't do that, because we don't exactly know what's going to happen. At the end of the day, it can't be, and it can't get a hell of a lot worse. What we need to do is get to the end of that diving board and jump.
Yeah, I like that attitude. I think that's amazing. My penultimate question to you, Derek, and for me, this is the big one, and we almost touched on it a minute ago when we were talking about species reintroduction, is do you ever see a time in the UK where we could have wolves back?
I think we should start a conversation about the wolf now. I think it's important that we start that conversation about the wolf now. If we were connected to mainland Europe, there wouldn't be a debate about this, and there wouldn't be a conversation. The animals would be back here now, because this animal from the past, lost in the 17th and 18th centuries, now accelerating back through Europe at a rapid rate of knots. And when it does, it's been welcomed. The big difference between wolves in the past and wolves now is that in the past, to exterminate them, you had to pretty much get to the stage where everybody in society agreed with you that they were a creature sent by Satan and that it was your Christian duty to eliminate them. And you know, it's not that way anymore. There was a lot of, you know, actually stupidity. There was a huge amount of vested interest. Cruelty beyond belief when it came to the extermination of this creature in Britain. And we know it. It's, the information's all there. All you've got to do is develop the ability to read. We should look at where we are because we ask the rest of the world to live with large carnivores while we do nothing. We ask the rest of the world to make huge sacrifices because we want to see things on TV at Sunday at 7 o'clock in a nature show and we do nothing. The wolf is not something we need to be scared of. They're not a problem for people. They are a problem for sheep, but the sheep are things that we've been subsidizing as taxpayers for a very, very long time without any clear idea whatsoever as to why we should have been doing it. Yeah. And the wolf, if we get, we're again going to look at changing a landscape, and we're going to say, right, okay, you know, we need more trees to catch more carbon, to cool the planet down, to create deep root systems that go down into the soil, that slow the flow of water, that make, that recreate a natural balance of a sort that we cannot simply manufacture in any other way. Now, the wolf is a forest guardian, because unlike the lynx, what wolves do is that they will instill a climate of fear in the languid deer that basically lie in those mountaintops and are not scared of anything we do. Mm. And then at night, they come down and they browse out the trees, they take the suckers, so that, you know, old granny aspens sending out these tiny, tiny, fragile, fragrant seedlings every year. It doesn't matter how long they live, they're never going to see any of these things prosper and grow. Every one of your offspring is going to die because the deer on the mountains will take them. And if the wolves were here, that would no longer be possible. This climate of complacency would be replaced by a climate of fear, and these animals would have to think twice and think hard about coming down to where they feed now. So I think the wolf is something we should start to talk about. I think there's a lot of nonsense. We need more understanding. But I think there's a very good case in the end for looking at the restoration of an animal like the wolf. I think it would be good from an ecological point of view for remote communities, probably good from an economic point of view. And as the not only the physical landscape, but the social fabric and the economic fabric of the countryside changes, I think the case for its restoration will only become stronger.
Amazing. I'm excited. I love wolves. So you saying that, I'm like, yes, let's have that chat now. Let's do it. Now, my last question is a question everyone gets at the end of Into the Wild. And that's, if you could pass on one bit of advice onto everyone regarding the natural world, Derek, what would you pass on?
You guys have to become more engaged. You have to become more active. You have to understand the issues that confront the survival of nature in this British landscape well. And you have to start asking for what you want. And I'd say this especially to any young people listening. I mean, there's a friend of mine, Roy Dennis, who's 84 years old now. And he said, you know, what he wishes he had done now, and he's done so much. He's the man that's reintroduced the white-tailed eagles to the Isle of Wight and ospreys to Poole Harbour. And he's just accomplished so much. But the, what he wished he could do now, had he time again, is ask for the things that you really want. Just go and ask. Go and ask. And when they come up with all the crap they come up with to tell you it cannot be, understand the issues well and confront them and don't take no. Make life uncomfortable. What Extinction Rebellion has shown us is that if you make life uncomfortable, then in the end, people will listen because there's truth. Truth is on your side. And it's time that we found a different way and a different balance. But if you basically just go along with the system and accept what it's going to give you, then bear in mind that your end will be one of immense dissatisfaction. And you'll look back in your life on the things that you could have done and really regret not acting at a time when it was possible. So ask now for what you want to do and make a fuss when people say you can't have it.
There you go. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you today. I feel pumped from this conversation. So it's been lovely to chat and hear your thoughts on rewilding and reintroduction. I wish you all the best throughout the next coming month. It's going to be a challenging one for everyone for many different reasons. I hope it's okay for yourself. And I also wish you best for the rest of the year.
Thank you very much.
Thanks again for listening. If you'd like to keep up to date with the projects of work Derek is working on, you can do so on Instagram at DerekJGo and on Twitter at Derek_Go. Don't forget, as always, you can get in touch with me at intothewildpod@gmail.com or on social media at intothewildpod on Twitter and intothewildpodcast on Instagram. Whether it's just to say hello, share some thoughts on an episode, or even let me know what you want to hear about next. Until next time, keep well, stay safe, and live the good life.